Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to update some matters relating to military affairs. We're going to begin with an article about a very important private military and security organization, which has been providing security functions of a paramilitary and intelligence variety to various multinational corporations. Research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience. This comes from the Multinational Monitor's issue of March of 1998. This article was authored by Pratap Chatterjee, Chatterjee, who is described as an investigative writer who tracks mercenary and mining operations for Project Underground, a Berkeley-based activist group. Again, this article from the Multinational Monitor, issue of March of 1998. The article is entitled, Guarding the Multinationals, DSL, and the International Private, quote, Security, unquote, Business. The article reads, on a Tuesday morning in late June last year, Alan Golachinsky, G-O-L-A-C-I-N-S-K-I, and Michael Golovatov, G-O-L-O-V-A-T-O-V, joined Jacksonville, Florida Mayor John Delaney at the dedication of a new building in the city's international trade port. Golachinsky is president of U.S. Defense Systems, a private company that provides security for U.S. embassies, especially in African countries. Golovatov is the director of a Moscow-based company known as Alpha A, which provides security for businesses transporting goods across the former Soviet Union. A decade before, the two men would have been bitter and probably deadly rivals. Golachinsky was White House security advisor, a position he rose to after 20 years in the State Department, while Golovatov spent an equal number of years working for the KGB's crack commando team, known at the time as Alpha. Both Golachinsky and Golovatov report to the same bosses, Richard Bethell and Sir Alistair Morrison, two ex-Special Air Service, or SAS, commandos in London. By the way, Bethell is B-E-T-H-E-L-L. Continuing, they run a profitable private company named Defense Systems Limited, or DSL, in London, in offices next to Buckingham Palace. Quote, who are the sorts of people that would be our clients? Petrochemical companies, mining or mineral extraction companies and their subsidiaries, multinationals, banks, embassies, non-governmental organizations, national and international organizations. Those people who operate in a very dodgy, hostile type of environment, unquote, Major General Stephen Carr Smith of DSL told Darius Bazargan, a British reporter, last year. Bazargan, B-A-Z-A-R-G-A-N. Continuing. Oil and gas companies top the list. Broken Hill Proprietary Petroleum of Australia, British Petroleum, Shell, and British Gas of the United Kingdom, Amoco, Chevron, Exxon, Mobil, and Texaco of the United States, Ranger of Canada. Mining companies like Cambior of Canada and De Beers of South Africa are also well represented. DSL has also supplied security services to embassies in countries torn by civil war, such as the Democratic Republic of the Congo, formerly Zaire, where their officers guard the United States, South African, and Swiss embassies. The company also worked in Angola, where its security guards policed the British, Italian, South African, Swedish, and U.S. embassies until January of 1998. The old boy network of the British and United States establishment has merged smoothly with the former Soviet intelligence agents. Quote, one of the reasons we think we're so successful is we understand the nature of the beast, unquote, Golachinsky told a Jacksonville reporter, explaining how DSL was able to obtain so many government contracts. The former rivals also have common skills and a common interest, providing strong-arm services and the pursuit of profit. Fortunately for the ex-spooks, as the Cold War ended, liberalization of the global economy generated a rush by multinationals into the Third World, and an accompanying demand for strong-arm services and intelligence-gathering operations to help guard the global corporation's destructive endeavors. The situation is not dissimilar to the 1950s, after the Second World War and the dismantling of the old European colonial empires, when De Beers hired former British counterintelligence officers like Sir Percy Sillitoe to launch a diamond war in Sierra Leone and evict rivals. That's, by the way, capital S-I-L-L-I-T-O-E. Sillitoe's army laid booby traps, mined border crossings, and ambushed traders until all diamond buyers were persuaded to sell their wares to De Beers. The modern equivalent of Sir Percy also goes further than just providing routine security guards to fill sentry boxes and sit behind bulletproof counter windows for the diamond merchants, oil drillers, and their ilk. DSL has provided counterinsurgency training for security forces in Sri Lanka, Papua New Guinea, and Mozambique. Bethel, who was nicknamed Tarzan because of his long blonde locks, personally organized a training mission of the Colombian police's elite force in 1990. The company's ability to provide one-stop shopping options for clients in search of a private army recently expanded. In early 1997, Defense Systems and Gorondel were bought by Armor Holdings, riot control equipment manufacturers in Jacksonville, Florida. Armor Holdings was originally known as American Body Armor, but changed its name a couple of years ago after it was rescued from bankruptcy caused by the failure of the Saudi Arabian government to pay a major bill. Through a newly acquired subsidiary named Defense Technology of America in Casper, Wyoming, Armor Holdings can now offer DSL clients a wide array of riot control toys. Defense technology literature offers prospective buyers pepper gas generators. Pepper gas is an extremely irritating chemical used by police forces, which has allegedly caused over 60 deaths in custody in recent years, as well as a variety of grenades for use by police or prison wardens. The company offers flameless expulsion grenades that can be used to fill a 12 by 20 foot room with a chemical agent in 4 to 5 seconds to control unruly crowds, rubber ball, unquote, tear gas grenades, which, unlike conventional tear gas dispensers, are hard to throw back, and, quote, stinger combo CS grenades, which contain an explosive charge allowing blast dispersion of rubber pellets that contain tear gas in a circular pattern over a distance of 50 feet. Defense Technology also offers grenade launchers, gas pistols and masks, riot shields, billy clubs, nightsticks, nickel-plated handcuffs, leg irons, batons, special devices for breaking down doors or barricades, and projectiles that explode with a loud report, and a brilliant flash to distract attention. Armor Holdings executives were exultant when the takeover of DSL was completed. Quote, as the leading global provider of specialist security services, DSL is positioned to continue its development both internally and through acquisition in a world requiring increasing security and intelligence services, unquote, said Jonathan Spiller, chief executive officer of Armor Holdings. For the riot control equipment manufacturers, Bethel and Goloshinsky's experiences as spooks and providing security are an excellent complement. Bethel worked for the SAS in Argentina during the British War against Argentina to take control of the Falkland Islands. Goloshinsky ran security at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran during the final days of the U.S.-backed regime of the Shah of Iran. And continuing, although Golovatov's personal history is not public, Alpha, the KGB unit he worked in for 20 years, was well known in its day for spearheading the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and crushing pro-independence protests in Lithuania. Both DSL and armor company officials have refused to comment on the integration of these companies. Goloshinsky and Morrison declined telephone and fax requests to be interviewed for this article. Nor was Spiller available for comment despite a number of attempts by Multinational Monitor to reach him. But emerging evidence gleaned from recent reports appears to indicate that, today, the past experiences of these men in the violent promotion of the colonial interests of Cold War rivals has been transformed into similar services for the extractive interests of multinational corporations, which are afraid of local communities protesting against the environmental and social devastation left behind by their operations. One of DSL's biggest contracts is with Mark Heathcote, a former MI6, British equivalent of the Central Intelligence Agency officer, who ran operations in Argentina during the Falklands War, who is now the Chief of Security for British Petroleum, or BP. Heathcote hired DSL to provide protection from Marxist rebels who have repeatedly dynamited Colombia's oil pipelines. In 1996, DSL sent a group of British trainers to secretly train Colombian police on BP rigs in lethal weapons handling, sniper fire, and close-quarter combat. An internal DSL fact dated October 1996 announced, quote, the effects of the training team are noticed in a positive manner, unquote. Another DSL fact states, quote, the police morale is high, and they have expressed their enjoyment of the training they have received. Good job to whoever was involved, unquote. In 1997, the second largest oil pipeline in Colombia, operated by Occidental Corporation of California, was blown up 65 times. The longest pipeline, run by BP, was blown up just once. The work of BP's police trainees is rather mysterious and was initially denied by BP when interviewed by an investigative television documentary team in Britain called World in Action. But a former DSL employee who talked to the filmmakers under the assumed name of Rod explained that the trainers were, quote, operating in Colombia without a contract. They can leave at any date, any time. They have separate accounts, monies deposited in England and in Colombia, unquote. Rod told World in Action that the training team was using the oil company's private airport terminal in Yopal, Colombia. Quote, I saw civilian-clothed personnel who were Colombians and an ex-SAS operative carrying the black boxes checking right through Yopal Airport, Rod said. They just put their weapons inside the box, their ammunition in another box, and went right through, not signing any forms. It could have been anything. It could have been 15 or 20 mini Uzis in a box. It didn't matter, unquote. Not surprisingly, BP's successful security operations have been plagued by accusations of intimidation of innocent civilians and human rights abuses. Quote, BP has to spend a fortune on security, and unfortunately, although it's not their policy, this leads to security forces threatening the local community, says Julio Cesar Rodriguez, chair of the oil committee in the Colombian Congress. Again quoting, the police are now getting more involved with patrolling activities that are the normal requirements of an infantry unit, which is definitely being seen by the population as another military force in the area. The people are scared to death. You can see it on their faces, said Rod. Daniel Bland, a human rights researcher for Justice and Peace, a Bogota-based inter-church coalition, told World in Action that the situation for local communities affected by the environmental and social consequences of the oil drilling has been dire. El Moro, a community at the heart of BP's newest oil field, was persecuted for forming a community group to complain about damage to their road and natural water supply, he says. Quote, in all the testimony we've received, any kind of organized protest against BP in any way, the leaders of those protests are singled out for persecution, for harassment, and for death threats, he said. Locals agree. Gabriel Narvaez, N-A-R-V-A-E-Z, president and advisor to the El Moro Association, explained, quote, in Colombia, to speak against the large state programs or those of the multinationals is an act of suicide. It is almost like condemning oneself to death, unquote. The documentary named Carlos Arregui and Gabriel Asensio as being among six members of the El Moro Association who were murdered after the group started campaigning over damage to their road. BP responded swiftly to the negative publicity in Britain after the World in Action documentary was aired. Quote, we reject the allegations altogether, says Ian Stewart, a spokesperson for BP in London. Again quoting, the whole thing was written in a relentlessly vindictive and adversarial manner. Defense systems simply provide supervisory staff for the security in our compounds at the drilling sites and gives us advice, unquote. The company asked the Fiscalía General, the Colombian judicial authorities, to investigate the charges made in the documentary, as well as an earlier unpublished Colombian human rights report. Suzanne Curtis, a BP spokeswoman in London, told Multinational Monitor that the Fiscalía General completed its report in February 1998, and the company was awaiting authorization to publish the findings. In recent years, DSL has discovered another potential gold mine of work, the United Nations, which is engaged in providing security in situations of conflict, and the World Bank, which arrives afterwards to provide reconstruction services. From 1992 to 1996, DSL was the largest private sector provider to the United Nations operations in the former Yugoslavia in tasks such as vehicle maintenance, providing drivers, warehousing, camp construction, mine clearance, and communications. DSL believes that it can expand the role of private security companies in operating the modern war machine. Carr Smith says, quote, my model is like a set of traffic lights. This small private sector planning team sits down working with the planners, and they're looking at a range of tasks which come within a range of three categories. Red tasks, which are those that only military logisticians can do, because of where it is, when they need it, they have to have the capability, reaction time, all those sorts of things. There are then going to be some green tasks that the private sector can and will do. An awful lot of things back in this country, ports of embarkation, ports of disembarkation, rear area type of stuff, unquote. And then there's the chunk in the middle, the amber bit, which are tasks that both the military and the private sector could do. But which of them does it will depend on the circumstances at the time. And in the early stages, they might dictate that the military logisticians do it. But over a period of time, which could be days or could be weeks or months, those tasks could swing for the private sector to do, unquote. DSL is positioning itself to provide, quote, post-conflict reconstruction, unquote, services, also according to company officials, by working with major infrastructure companies like Tarmac Wimpey in Britain and Bechtel of San Francisco, or Bechtel of San Francisco, excuse me. Not surprisingly, these infrastructure companies also offer essential services to multinational extraction and manufacturing operations in third world countries. In Algeria, DSL guards Bechtel contractors providing services to oil companies like BP. DSL is only one of scores of private sector operations that offer security services to multinational companies. Others, like Executive Outcomes of South Africa, will even provide fighting forces to take over rebel areas, as indeed it has done in countries from Angola and Sierra Leone to Papua New Guinea. The mushrooming of these services appears to be to substantiate the arguments made by Martin van Creveld, C-R-E-V-E-L-D, a war theoretician in his 1991 book, The Transformation of War. This next couple of paragraphs is very important. Quote, as used to be the case until at least 1648, military and economic functions will be reunited, van Creveld writes. Much of the day-to-day burden of defending society against the threat of low-intensity conflict will be transferred to the booming security business, and indeed the time may come when the organizations that comprise that business will take over the state. In the future, says van Creveld, armed conflicts around the world will resemble the old. War-making entities, he said, will look a lot like they did in the feudal past. Tribes, city-states, religious associations, private mercenary bands, and commercial organizations such as the East India Company in the time of the British Empire. I would add there's a good book about private intelligence services that work with major corporations. That book actually came out in the late 70s. It's called Spooks and was authored by Jim Hogan, last name H-O-U-G-A-N. Probably the best known of the private security companies in this country is the Wackenhut Corporation. That's discussed in, among other programs, a program about the Innslaw case. We have Ways of Making You Sell. That's a miscellaneous archive show that's available from Spitfire. A very interesting observation here in that the privatization of military functions and in turn their coordination and to an extent merging with major economic entities such as transnational corporations is, I think, a line of analysis to be taken very seriously here and to be considered at considerable length. It's also interesting here that von Creveld, or Creveld, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, writes, much of the day-to-day burden of defending society against the threat of low-intensity conflict will be transferred to the booming security business, and indeed the time may come when the organizations that comprise that business will take over the state, unquote. I would also add that many of those private security and intelligence operations work hand-in-glove with and as proxies for major state internal intelligence and security organizations. The CIA, among other organizations, works very closely with such entities. As I'm speaking on the evening of March 21st, 1999, or recording this on the evening of March 21st of 1999, the San Francisco Bay Area has just been host to the San Francisco Bay Area, like many other American urban areas, has just played host to a training operation called Urban Warrior, in which the United States Marines conducted a number of different operations to give them practice in operating in dense urban areas where the problems of warfare and operations in general are considerably different than they would be in a more rural area. The public relations presentation of these operations is that they were largely counter-terrorist or humanitarian in nature. A number of people have been very concerned, though, that perhaps these operations could be a dress rehearsal for the utilization of the Marines against civilians here in the United States. That was the spin on an article that was carried in the San Francisco Bay Guardian on March 10th of 1999. Their website, by the way, is www.sfbg.com. That's www.sfbg.com. And a tip of the hat to a listener who researched this for us. This article is entitled One Nation Under God. One Nation Under Guard, And it's subtitled, The Marine Corps is making plans to take over U.S. cities during popular insurrections. They're practicing in Oakland next week. And again, this from the San Francisco Bay Guardian of March 10th, 1999, authored by Gar Smith. The article reads in part as follows. Forget the Middle East, forget Kosovo. The United States Marine Corps is convinced that its next major invasion may take place on the west coast of the United States. That's right. The Marines are preparing to put down an insurrection in a major American city, say San Francisco or Seattle or Los Angeles. They'll be practicing in Oakland March 15th through 18th. The Marines say the exercise, dubbed Urban Warrior Advanced Warfighting Experiment, is designed to teach the armed forces how to distribute humanitarian aid to a big city after a disaster. But a Bay Guardian review of hundreds of pages of military documents obtained through public records requests from the Marine Corps' website and from the Alameda County Public Library reveals a very different mission. The Marine Corps' plans for the invasion reveal that Urban Warrior is designed to give Marines practice in seizing control of urban areas, including taking over food and water supplies, utilities, and communication systems. And statements and articles by military leaders suggest that the armed forces are preparing themselves to contain popular uprisings, including uprisings in U.S. cities. And skipping down in the story, a review of hundreds of pages of documents regarding urban warrior exercises around the country and in the Bay Area reveals no plans for providing humanitarian assistance. The actual goal of the operation is clearly stated. It is to, quote, penetrate, unquote, quote, thrust, unquote, and, quote, swarm, unquote, into urban settings to seize power plants, TV and radio stations, and food and water supplies to suppress any local opposition and ultimately to control the cities. Urban warrior strategists envision a future battlefield defined by stateless war in an urban terrain against threats including criminals with computers and terrorists searching for weapons of mass destruction, unquote. Curiously, they don't have them, they are merely searching for them. Marine Corps documents explain that the Bay Area operation will pit, quote, an enhanced combat operations center against a well-trained, well-equipped opposing force with the capability to detonate a weapon of mass destruction, a biochemical weapon of mass destruction in an urban environment, unquote. And skipping down again, urban troops should rely on the, quote, opportune use of indigenous resources, the documents state, developing our ability to effectively forage for power, water, and fuel may provide a significant reduction in the logistics requirement on the sea bases, unquote. Unfortunately, such foraging would mean seizing resources from the indigenous population. But that can have its own advantages. To gain leverage in establishing control over the urban environment, unquote, urban warriors are advised to seize power plants, water plants, and food storage and distribution centers. Another section of the urban warrior game plan is more direct, recommending operations, quote, designed to collapse essential functions, unquote. And skipping down still again, while urban warriors promoters say such exercises train Marines to enter foreign trouble spots, military documents challenge that assertion. There are few 15-story urban canyons in third world cities, and the photographers in urban warrior strategic documents portray targets much closer to home, Seattle, Miami, San Diego, New York City, and San Francisco. In a rare reference to non-Western countries, the conceptual framework points out that urban warfare is fundamentally unsuited to most cities in the developing world. Quote, the squalor and highly inflammable nature of building materials within many non-Western urban areas, coupled with the wide use of propane or natural gas for heating and services, creates a risk of catastrophic fire, the document states. I would interject that also could be used for military purposes of a very draconian nature. I also would slightly dispute that there are few third world countries that have 15-story urban canyons. There actually are quite a few high-rise buildings in third world countries, although frequently the people who inhabit those buildings or work in them exist side by side with people living in abject squalor. Continuing. Meanwhile, plans are afoot to increase the military's power in the event of a national emergency. Earlier this year, a disturbing proposal to commission a supreme military commander to take charge in the event of a terrorist threat, unquote, received a favorable nod from the White House. A January 28 story in the New York Times reported that, quote, the Pentagon has decided to ask President Clinton for the power to appoint a military leader for the continental U.S. because of what it sees as a growing threat of major terrorist strikes on U.S. soil, unquote. The Times reported that, again quoting, top White House officials have reacted favorably, unquote, despite concerns from civil libertarians that, again quoting, such military power could slowly expand to threaten the privacy, liberty, and lives of private citizens, unquote. The U.S. Marine Corps document Why Urban Warrior suggests that foreign terrorists aren't the only domestic threat the military is readying itself to address. According to Urban Warrior strategists, approximately 85% of the world's population will live in cities by 2025, and these cities will contain, quote, all the classic ingredients for conflict. There will be social, cultural, religious, and tribal strife between different groups. Many areas will have scarce resources, including the most basic ones like food and shelter. As populations grow and resources shrink even further, the chances for conflict will naturally grow with it, unquote. In a January article in Armed Forces Journal International, Colonel James A. Lasswell, LASSWELL, head of experimental operations for the MCWL, puts it even more directly, quote, there will be widespread economic problems and cultural, ethnic, and tribal tensions, many caused by wave after wave of immigration, unquote. In another issue of the same publication, Major General Scales minces no words about the military's role in urban warfare in the decades ahead. To fight on behalf of the rich against the poor. Quote, the future urban center will contain a mixed population ranging from the rich elite to the poor and disenfranchised, he writes, again quoting, day-to-day existence for most of the urban poor will be balanced tenuously on the edge of collapse. With social conditions ripe for exploitation, the smallest tilt of unfavorable circumstance might be enough to instigate starvation, disease, social foment, cultural unrest, or other forms of urban violence. The enormous problems of infrastructure and the demand for social services that threaten to swamp governing authorities in the urban centers of emerging states will most likely worsen, unquote, Scales predicts, again quoting, moreover, the proximity of the disenfranchised to the ruling elite provides the spark for further unrest and sporadic violence, unquote. Indeed, I think that these are considerations that should be carefully considered in evaluating this article. We should note, too, that martial law plans have been on the books for quite some time, with their genesis going back to the California Specialized Training Institute in San Luis Obispo under Ronald Reagan and Louis Zufrida in the late 1960s. That's discussed in RFA 23. And there's also discussion of the martial law contingency plans in RFA 32, RFA 38, and also a miscellaneous archive show about the state defense forces. So certainly we are well aware that we certainly know that there are plans to institute martial law in given areas in the event of any one of a number of catastrophes. This is not to be misconstrued as militia-type propaganda, but it is simply a matter of public record. I've alluded to the archive shows. Those are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email address spitfire@ix.netcom.com. The web address is www.spitfirelist.com. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.